From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This weekend kicks off the summer season. On today's Fresh Air, summer reading. We feature an interview with a writer who has two current bestsellers, bound to be popular choices for beach reading, John Grisham. His books like A Time to Kill, The Client, and The Firm have been made into movies. And for readers who like to be transported to foreign lands without actually having to travel, book critic Maureen Carrigan tells us about some surefire getaways. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As we kick off the summer season with a Memorial Day weekend, we feature an interview with a writer who's a longtime popular choice for summer reading, John Grisham. He's the author of the best-selling legal thrillers The Firm, The Client, The Pelican Brief, A Time to Kill, and his two current bestsellers, The Partner and The Runaway Jury. Even if you haven't read any of his books, you've probably seen some of their film adaptations. Before he was the king of the legal thriller, he was what he describes as a street lawyer in a suburb of Memphis. Last February, I talked with him about his books and about the legal career that led to them. We started by discussing his latest book, The Partner. The story begins as a lawyer named Patrick Lanigan fakes his death, watches his burial, changes his identity, and goes into hiding with $90 million stolen from his Biloxi law firm. I asked John Grisham if he ever had the fantasy of changing his identity and disappearing from his legal work.
I can't say that I wanted to, you know, disappear, leave my family, all that stuff, change appearances. But escapism is fairly a common fantasy, I think, among a lot of people, especially a lot of lawyers who are sort of trapped in small towns, small practices, and not making a lot of money, bad marriages, whatever. And I've known several of those guys over the years who have actually tried to escape.
By changing jobs or by changing
identities? No, by stealing the money and running.
Really? Like the character in your book?
Yeah, I don't know of any who've actually changed, physically changed their identities to the extent that Patrick does in the book. But they have stolen money and disappeared, and, you know, when they left town, they thought they were leaving for good. I know of a very famous case in Mississippi where a lawyer actually faked his own death in a manner very similar to Patrick's and took a bunch of money, disappeared, and got caught. So it happens.
It's funny, you were able to leave law by writing books, and without having to steal money, you ended up making a lot of money. Did you want out really badly?
I wanted out. At the same time, I could have been a lawyer forever. I thought that's what I would do. I had done it for 10 years and had achieved a level of success to where, you know, my family was comfortable and the kids were small. And I just thought that I would do that forever. At the same time, as the years went by, I found the profession less and less fulfilling and began thinking of, you know, sure it'd be nice to get out of it. And again, that's pretty common among the lawyers I knew and still know.
You've been writing legal thrillers for almost as long as you practiced law. Do you want to write other kinds of books?
Yeah, I will one day. I think the legal thrillers will run their course. Popular fiction is very cyclical. And in in a few years, these books will not be as popular as they are now, for whatever reasons. And I hope I have the sense to recognize that, that one of these days the books may not be, my books may not be delivering what people expect. And I hope I have the good sense to write something else. I'd like to. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I'd be foolish to, jump ship now and try a different genre.
Right.
Something's working, yeah.
You've said that your first novel, A Time to Kill, was in many ways your most autobiographical. And in the introduction to the republication, you write a little bit about that. Let me just read a paragraph. You write, "One day I stumbled upon a horrible trial in which a young girl testified against the man who brutally raped her. It was a gut-wrenching experience for me, and I was only a spectator. One moment she was courageous, the next pitifully frail. I was mesmerized. I could not imagine the nightmare she and her family had been through. I wondered, what would I do if she were my daughter? As I watched her suffer before the jury, I wanted personally to shoot the rapist. For one brief yet interminable moment, I wanted to be her father. I wanted justice. There was a story there." And that's the story that you developed into A Time to Kill. Did you think you were capable of that kind of revenge?
At that moment, I sure did. In that courtroom, only a few feet away from the defendant, all of us who were there, I think collectively we felt very capable of inflicting some measure of revenge upon this defendant who had, done things to this little girl that beyond description. But there were moments during her testimony when I was facing the jury, off to the side, and I knew three of the jurors, three out of the 15, and they were all covering their eyes because they were crying. And the judge was also trying to cover his eyes. And the prosecutor, a man I knew well and who could cry instantly, was also crying. And even the defendant's own lawyers were, studying their shoes. And it, was beyond, emotion's not an adequate word. But I think it would have been easy right then at that moment to get revenge.
People were crying during the daughter's testimony?
Yeah, little girl's testimony. It was just, she would start crying, and before long, everybody else was covering their faces. And it was, this went on for a couple hours, and the courtroom was locked. The spectators had been excluded by the judge because he knew her testimony would be so graphic and so difficult for her. She was only 12 years old. And it was, we just suffered through it, and I was very anxious to get out of there. I was just a nosy spectator.
Yeah, why were you there in the first place? I mean, you had your own cases. What interested you?
It was in the early days of my legal career, and at times, if I didn't have a lot to do, I'd go hang around the courtroom, especially if good lawyers were in town trying good cases, because I wanted to be a trial lawyer. And this particular crime had been so heinous and so notorious that we knew when the trial was going to occur, and so I just kind of hung around one day to see what was going to happen. And suddenly there I was in a courtroom, and the local lawyers can come and go at will, pretty much, in a courtroom, and we know the judges and all that. And so the judge was not going to exclude me when he closed the courtroom. We took a break after a couple hours of this, and because the little girl just had to have a break, and the judge kept asking her if she wanted a break, and finally she said yes, and so we cleared the courtroom, and everyone was anxious to leave the courtroom, the jury, the judge, and we did. And in my haste to get out of the courtroom, I left behind my briefcase, and I didn't realize it until I was at my car, which is downstairs outside, and I realized I had to go back in the courtroom to get my briefcase. And I walked back through the back entrance of the courthouse, up the back stairs, through a side door, and suddenly there I was in the courtroom, and no one had stopped me, and I walked right by the defendant, who was sitting in a chair with a deputy a few feet away, the only two people in the courtroom. And it dawned on me how easy it would be to, get to the man who did that to my child. And it just floored me to think that I could have done it. I mean, and that's when the story was born.
This is an interesting thing about your position as a lawyer or a former lawyer and a novelist. As a lawyer, is your position to uphold the law. As the novelist, you're always creating characters who break it.
Yeah, and I'm troubled by that. I mean, I think I'll always be troubled by the story of A Time to Kill because it condones vigilantism and that type of justice. And, we cannot function as a society if the victims of crimes are allowed to seek their own remedies. And I don't know if I would write that story again.
John Grisham is my guest. In that first novel, A Time to Kill, you describe the lawyer Jake Brigens as he was clean-cut, conservative, a devout Presbyterian with a pretty wife who wanted babies. How close does that come to describing what you were like when you started your law career?
Pretty close. Again, there's a lot of autobiography. I'm not sure my wife wanted babies when we had them, but it was a joint effort. Small town, struggling lawyer, working hard, trying to get a break, trying to get a big case, trying to get a reputation in a town that's, filled with lawyers.
Clean cut, conservative?
Yeah, maybe not that conservative, maybe more of a politically moderate, Baptist, not Presbyterian, few differences. Clean cut, I guess, yeah.
What were your typical cases? If there's such a thing as typical cases.
Well, in the early days, the first 3 or 4 years of my law practice, I did a lot of criminal work, court-appointed criminal work for indigent clients who could not afford attorneys. Back then in our local county, we didn't have a full-time public defender, so the criminal cases were assigned on a rotating basis to the younger lawyers. The older lawyers, of course, had to do it when they were younger, so it was an unwritten rule that the guys fresh out of law school would take the indigent cases, and I did a lot of those. The first year, I'd been out of law school less than a year when I had my first murder trial, which I was not equipped to handle. And then there was another murder trial shortly after that, and so I jumped into a lot of high-pressure courtroom work fresh out of law school, and that was fine with me because I wanted to do that kind of work, and I hoped to sort of gain the courtroom experience, become a good trial lawyer, as fast as possible, and later try more lucrative civil cases, and that's kind of what happened.
Did you feel guilty representing clients in cases that you felt you were not ready to really take on yet?
I would have felt guilty if we lost them, but I won both the murder cases with not guilty verdicts, and that does a lot for your confidence.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. And did you always truly believe in the innocence of the people you were defending, or did you have to be in the? Were you in the position sometimes of defending people who you really thought were guilty?
Both the murder cases involved some very strong defenses of self-defense. These were shootings, and the question was who shot first. And my client did, in fact, kill the deceased, but the deceased in both cases were heavily armed. And, again, it's a question of self-defense. There were some cases I wouldn't take. I mean, I would never have defended a rapist or a child molester. I simply, refused to do that. I represented a lot of people who were very guilty, and I never had any moral problems doing that. Lawyers can't worry about such things. Under our, judicial and constitutional system, everybody's entitled to an attorney. And regardless of what you're charged with, you're entitled to legal representation. Somebody has to do it.
My guest is John Grisham. He has a new novel called The Partner. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Grisham is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Partner. Are there many cases in your novels that actually come from cases that you or colleagues close to you took on, or do you mostly invent things and make them a little bit larger than life?
Oh, much larger than life.
Right.
Just,
okay.
This is fiction, okay?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just outright fabrication.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't... I'm sure real live lawyers and real life cases sort of seep into the novels, but I don't build stories around them. I'm much more interested in creating something that's brand new, a big trial against the insurance industry and the Rainmaker, or the trial against the tobacco industry and the runaway jury, or I'd rather paint a larger canvas and maybe call some of my personal experiences occasionally, as minor subplots. I don't really want to write about real people.
Why not?
Even fictionalized versions. Well, I don't want to get sued for one thing.
Oh, yeah, sure. But real kind of people. Do you want to write?
Well, I think a lot of my lawyers are stereotypes of or combinations of real people. I mean, I study lawyers. I watch lawyers. I did when I was an attorney. I'd watch the good trial lawyers, and I spend a lot of time now watching lawyers, keeping up with legal developments, keeping up with trials. And most of my characters are compilations of, real lawyers.
Do you go to the courthouse a lot now, or do you stay home and watch court TV?
Neither. I deplore the idea of televised trials. I always thought there was some sanctity in a very dignified courtroom where people could go and discuss things they would never discuss outside their own homes because they had to testify. But court TV has made a mockery of all that, and it's turned the actors and judges into, media celebrities and actors. I don't really hang around courtrooms because, for the most part, it's very boring stuff. And I can't think of anything worse than watching a long trial. But I follow trials. You can get the daily summaries in the papers. And I'm always, watching issues and trying to piece together stories from current issues.
What was your most celebrated case when you were a lawyer?
I guess it happened a year ago, the last time I walked back into a courtroom. I'd been out of the law practice for 6 years, and it was the last holdover case from my law practice, and it involved the death of a railroad worker in a small town in southern Mississippi. And we had the trial in January of last year, and it was well covered. Before that, back when I was actively practicing all the time, celebrated case. I'm not sure I had a celebrated case. I had a couple of very nice civil cases that were settled before they went to trial. That meant a lot to me as an attorney and financially and all that. But none that I would say celebrated.
Did you have a case that you considered to be your greatest failure?
Yeah. There's one case that comes to mind involving a young man who was charged with concealed weapons. He was passing through our town when his car broke down. And the police found him beside the road. He was trying to get help. They searched his car illegally and found a couple of pistols and a shotgun and a knife. And they, under our law, they, you know, they were concealed weapons. And they're felonies. And the guy had no record. And there was no proof whatsoever that he was up to anything bad. He was from Missouri. And was passing through. And anyway, I had a deal worked out where the kid basically would plead to a misdemeanor charge and get in his car and leave and promise never to come back. And that deal fell through. He was indicted for 3 or 4 counts of felony possession of firearms. There was no defense to it. And so I worked out as good a plea agreement as I could. And he pled guilty and he went to the state penitentiary at Parchman, Mississippi, which is, like most state penitentiaries, is a, you know, terrible place. And he was not a big, strong guy. He was kind of frail. And he was seriously abused, sexually abused, for a long period of time. And I couldn't do anything about it. His mother found out about it. I tried to intervene. And we were just, it was very difficult to get anything done because it's so common. And he later committed suicide in the prison. And I look back to the day when, you know, we had a deal worked out where the kid could get in his car and drive off and, you know, never be heard from again. And it was a perfect example of somebody who had no business whatsoever going to prison because he had not really done anything wrong and was not planning on it. And, you know, I still think about that kid. I still wonder maybe if I could have done something more.
Did you usually leave cases feeling good about the law or feeling like you were let down by the results?
Most of the time, the system works. Most of the time, juries do what's right. Most of the time, settlements are fair. They're negotiated by both sides. And so, the vast majority of the time when I closed a file, I was happy with what had been done. The clients were somewhat satisfied, and it was time to close the file and move on.
The suicide of the young man you mentioned seems to have had quite an effect on you. Is there anything based on his case that ended up in one of your novels?
Not yet. Not yet. Everything is, you know, everything is a possibility for a novel, but I think I'd have a hard time writing about that kid.
Too close?
Very close.
John Grisham will be back with us in the second half hour of our show. His latest legal thriller is called The Partner. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our interview with John Grisham, and book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends some travel adventure books for summer reading. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with John Grisham, the mega-successful author of such legal thrillers as A Time to Kill, The Firm, The Client, The Pelican Brief, The Runaway Jury, and The Partner. When we left off, we were talking about his life before he started writing, when he was a criminal lawyer. Was it interesting for you to watch how some people deal with pressure, how some people break and other people are able to manage during a trial?
Yeah, trial work is very stressful. It's high-powered, high stakes, tons of pressure. And I've seen lawyers crack up in long trials. Others seem to thrive on the combat in the courtroom.
What about you? How'd you do?
I didn't really enjoy it. I mean, I thought I wanted to be a trial lawyer, but honestly, I never had any fun in the courtroom. I never enjoyed myself, even when I was winning. You don't win until it's all over, so you can't. You worry about defeat up until the very end. But I had trials against lawyers who just seemed to love the sport and the pressure of the courtroom. And I was never that way. I never was able to relax. I'd lose sleep. You know, long trial, you don't eat much, you don't sleep much. A lot of lawyers turn to alcohol because of that, because it is high pressure. And I knew a lot of those guys, but I didn't handle the pressure very well.
What about the competition in the games opposing lawyers play with each other, trying to psych each other out? Did that trouble you too?
Yeah, it really does, because it did, because especially if, the opposing lawyer was from a very large firm, and it seemed like he always was, because I was a sole practitioner. I was what we called ourselves street lawyers, because we were representing people out on the streets, people who were injured or wronged or fired or whatever. And typically we're always suing insurance companies and big defendants, and they hire big lawyers and big firms, and they all come in packs and dress alike and, have fancy degrees, and they just descend on the courtroom, and it can be very intimidating. And I always wanted to be one of those plaintiff's lawyers who could take on, a small army of defense lawyers and do so successfully. I never made it, but there could be a lot of intimidation, and there was a lot of intimidation imposed on a young lawyer struggling to keep up with the big boys.
You were in the state legislature for a while. Why did you decide to run in 1983?
I decided to run in 1978, 79. I just started law school, and I almost ran in 79 while I was in law school. It was sort of a single issue. I was embarrassed because at that time Mississippi was the only state with no public kindergarten system, and I wanted to be elected to the legislature and to work hard for public education in Mississippi. And that's why I ran in 1983 That was basically my platform, was public education. And got elected and took office in 84 and lasted a few years.
What year did you start writing your first novel?
Started in November of 84, same year I took office in the legislature.
Busy man. You were still practicing law, too?
Oh, yeah, that was what I was doing for a living. I mean, the legislature didn't pay hardly anything. The book writing was still a distant dream. And the only way I could write was to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and go to the office and write for an hour or two before the day started. And I did that over a period of, well, I got in the habit of doing it, and over a period of 3 years, the first book was completed, and it became so ingrained that when I finished A Time to Kill, I think virtually the next day I started writing the next book, which was The Firm.
When you were writing A Time to Kill and going to the office at 5:30 every morning, was that your home office or your legal office?
Oh, that was my legal office. It was about 5 minutes from my house. And it was on the like the main drag of our main street of our little town of 25,000, which is a suburb of Memphis, just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And so I would be there at 5:30 in the morning. I'd turn on all the lights so everybody driving by to work would be able to see that I was there, at 5:30 in the morning.
Why, so you'd look industrious?
Yeah, I got the reputation as a real hard-working young lawyer,
Little did they know you weren't working on anybody's case.
I was up there trying to finish a book. And it was kind of funny, after The Time to Kill came out and I told the story, I had clients who said, so that's why my file never got taken care of. We were up there trying to write a novel.
So nobody knew you were really writing a novel?
Nobody but my wife. Nobody. I didn't tell anybody until the book was finished. Renee read each chapter as I wrote it, but she was the only one. I mean, I wasn't about to tell anybody. And it took 3 years, and at least for 2 years, the first 2 years, I was not even sure I was going to finish it. I mean, there was really nothing to talk about. And I remember one day realizing that the story was half through, and at some point in there I was determined to go ahead and finish it, but there was a lot of doubt. I think I went 4 weeks one time without working on it, and there were many times when I didn't want to work on it. It was just, I mean, I didn't want to get up at 5 in the morning. I wanted to sleep for another hour or so, and I often wonder now, what would have happened had I quit.
Do you ever wonder why you had this urge then to write before you knew if it was anything in it for you, if you could even complete the book?
Well, I wanted to see if I could do it. I wanted to get it typed and have this big stack of pages and then try to get it published. And once I realized I was going to finish it, then I began having all these wonderful dreams about getting it published. And once you start thinking about getting published, you start thinking about bestsellers and movies and all that stuff, and it's a whole lot of fun to dream about that, and I got caught up in that. And that prompted me to finish the book and to write the next one and to start thinking about just the dream of a big book and lots of money.
You said, how did the dream compare to the reality?
You can only dream so much. The reality is far in excess of anything I ever dreamed back then. It is an enormous amount of fun to be able to write for a living, and to have the books, well received by a lot of folks, and it's still a dream.
Now, your second novel, The Firm, sold to a movie studio before it was even published. What a trick! How did that happen?
It was an accident. I did not orchestrate it. We did not know anything about it until it was almost over. I sent the manuscript to my agent here in New York in the early fall of 89, and he showed it to a few publishers, and there was no great stampede to buy The Firm. In fact, we really had no offers. He wanted me to do some more work on it. My agent did. I didn't want to do any more work on it. And it just sort of languished in his office throughout the fall of 89. At some point, a bootleg copy of the manuscript surfaced and was sent by a scout here in New York to a producer in L.A. And the producer in L.A. ran off, 25 copies of it and submitted to every major studio. And we knew nothing about that. There was no book deal. And the first inkling that I had that something was about to happen was a phone call from my agent, a very hurried phone call saying that he needed my authority to take the highest offer from Paramount, Universal, or Disney for the film rights to The Firm. And I said, what happened to the book rights? I thought we were going to have a book deal. And he said to something to the effect that we'll talk about that later. Right now we've got to have the final round of bidding in L.A. And that's how it happened. It was a big deal. And then 2 weeks later we sold the publication rights to Doubleday. But it happened, virtually overnight, totally unexpected.
When movies are made now of your books, I think you keep control. You have script approval, casting approval, director approval. Why is it important for you to have that? I think there's two schools of thought with novelists. One is, let them have it. They give me the money. They do with it what they want to. It's not a book anymore. It's a movie. Out of my control. And the other school of thought is to try to keep control and make it make the movie as close to your vision as possible.
Yeah, you nailed it. Those two schools of thought, and I honestly don't know which one's the best. The first theory is Stephen King's, where you and he told me this. You take all the money up front, you kiss it goodbye, and you expect it to be something different. And if you don't like that, then don't take the money. Keep the film rights. And I've tried that a couple of times. The second theory is that if you can get control, you get it, and you still get the money up front because you're not going to see it on the back end. And I don't know. I mean, I got a lot of control with The Time to Kill, casting and location and director and all that. But I also was dealing with somebody I trusted, Joel Schumacher, I knew would direct the movie, and I trusted him to make a faithful adaptation, which he did. Subsequent to that, we've sold film rights to The Runaway Jury and also to The Rainmaker, and I did not insist on casting approvals and director approvals and all that. I did want to write the screenplay for those two, and I have. But I have no plans to sell the film rights to the partner. I'm taking a break from that. It's
why?
The movies, I'm not mad at anybody, but the movies add an entirely different, heavier layer of notoriety and stress and loss of privacy that I'm just not crazy about. I've had five movies. There are three in various stages of post-production, pre-production, whatever. And that's eight. And that's an awful lot, for anybody. And I just... when people start telling me they're not going to buy the book, they're just going to wait on the movie, something's wrong. It's time to take a break from movies.
Mm. My guest is John Grisham. He has a new novel called The Partner. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. John Grisham is my guest, and he has a new novel called The Partner. Now, you, a while ago, sued the estate of your former agent, who had since passed away, on charges of funneling funds to a lawyer that the agent suggested hiring. So you became part of the legal... you became a plaintiff in the legal system.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to face the legal system suing the estate of somebody who you'd worked with? Did you find yourself feeling different about lawyers or the whole system?
It was not something I was anxious to do. And I can't say a lot about the lawsuit. There's since been a settlement, but both sides throughout the the actual lawsuit and the settlement and now post-settlement, we all agreed that we would not discuss it. And I think that's the best way to leave it. As far as actually being involved in litigation as a plaintiff, it's not something I want to do a lot of. What is a lot worse than that is being a defendant. I got sued a couple years ago by a person claiming I stole the idea for the chamber from her book, and that is very uncomfortable. It was a totally frivolous lawsuit. The judge threw it out after a year of, you know, some heavy lawyering on both sides. But it's, I'm going to try my best to avoid lawsuits.
I think that's good advice for anybody.
I don't really want to file anymore myself, and I can't control it. People want to sue me. One lawsuit per book, believe it or not, is about average, I guess.
People smell money and figure, let's take them to court.
Sure. I mean, when they print all your contracts and income and Forbes magazine, all that stuff, you become an easy target. So because of that, I'm very careful when I write books. I don't want to get close to real people, real companies. I'd prefer not to be sued. Life's too short.
I know when you were young, you moved around a lot. Your father worked for a construction company, I believe.
Correct.
And was transferred a lot. So what are some of the different places you lived in as a boy?
I was born in Black Oak, Arkansas, on a farm. We were cotton farmers. And I lived there for the first 6 years of my life. And then we decided to leave the farm because it was a pretty rough life. We moved to Crenshaw, Mississippi, which is a very small town in the Delta region of the state. From there, we moved to Delhi, Louisiana, and I was there for the second grade. From there, we moved to Parkin, Arkansas, and I was there for the third, fourth, and fifth grades. From there, we moved to Ripley, Mississippi, and I was there for the sixth grade. And from there, we moved to South Haven, Mississippi, which became home. And I was there from the age of 12 to the age of, 35. My wife grew up there. Our families are still close to that area, to the Memphis area. 6 years ago, we moved to Oxford, which is an hour down the road, and that's what we call home now. We are living right now in Charlottesville, Virginia. Just outside of Charlottesville, we've been sort of hiding out there for a couple of years.
Your mother was a devout Christian. Were you raised in a very religious environment?
Both my parents were and are grandparents on both sides, aunts, uncles. It was, which is not unusual in the Deep South. We were devout Southern Baptists. I'm still a Southern Baptist. This is my wife. We are Christians, trying to raise our kids in a Christian home. That's the way we were raised, and that's what we believe now.
But was there ever a moment when you found faith and law to be incompatible?
Yeah. There were times, especially in the area of divorce. I was never much of a divorce lawyer because I thought the divorce laws were designed to make divorce almost like an assembly line, you know, very weak grounds for divorce and anybody could walk out. And because of that, I just didn't do a lot of divorce work. That was an area where I think my faith intervened, and I just said, I'm not going to do this. Also, we mentioned, you know, certain types of crimes I just didn't have the stomach for. And certain types of clients. I mean, one time I was a guy who owned a series of shady businesses. I mean, the topless joints, and he wanted to hire me to do some legal work, and the fees would have been very lucrative. And I just didn't feel like representing somebody like that. I mean, I knew he could find a lawyer anywhere, and I just didn't want to be associated with him. So there were several times in my legal career where I think my faith had something to do with turning down clients.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but, you know, you were telling us how when you started writing while you were practicing law, you'd go to your office at 5 or 5:30 in the morning and turn on the lights and write. How does the process of writing compare now?
I go to my office at 5 o'clock in the morning, I turn on the lights, and I write. it's really, I guess habits are hard to break, but when I'm really under the gun, facing a deadline and trying to get it finished, which is usually the last 2 or 3 months of a six-month writing process, I'll get back in the old habit of 5 o'clock in the morning in the office, which the office now is right behind the house, and work real hard with few interruptions and lots of black coffee until about noon. And on a good day, I can produce 8 to 10 pages of manuscript. On a bad day, it's 4 or 5, but it's every day.
John Grisham, I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
John Grisham recorded last February after the publication of his latest novel, The Partner. Coming up, some summer reading suggestions from our book critic, Maureen Corrigan. This is Fresh Air. This Memorial Day weekend, as always, people across the country will be piling into cars, trains, and planes. But book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends a stay-at-home strategy for those seeking travel adventure.
My earliest travel memory is of being around 5 years old and looking out the window of my parents' apartment in Queens, New York. In the distance, I saw what I later learned was a radio tower and a tall bank building surmounted by a clock face. "That's the Eiffel Tower and Big Ben," I announced to my mother, who responded with the bad news that, no, everything as far as the eye could see was still Queens. Something about that nascent experience of being safe at home and yet encountering strange places has left me with a taste for armchair traveling. Who needs the hassle and expense of arranging a trip when for $17.95 you could curl up with the Traveler's Tales Guide to Hong Kong and in seconds be in an exotic health restaurant eating double-boiled turtle glue with wild ginseng? The Traveler's Tales Guides are not Frommer's-type manuals that give you tips on where to eat and sleep. Rather, they're handsome paperback collections of nonfiction travel stories written by amateurs as well as by big names like Richard Rodriguez and Bruce Chatwin. I dipped into the guides for Hong Kong, Paris, and San Francisco and read about one man's erotic misadventures in Gay Paris and the 99 varieties of light in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. The story I can't get out of my head, though, is by a retired airline pilot named Joseph Diedrich. It's called The Gift, and it describes a cognac-soaked night Diedrich spent in Paris with a sad folk singer and a ruined woman. Traveler's Tales Guides not only transport readers to faraway lands, but also introduce them to off-the-beaten-track unknown writers. Only a literary travel pro like Jan Morris, however, can take me to one of the places I most yearn to visit— New York City right after World War II, when automats, trolleys, and department store palaces still crowded Fifth Avenue. Morris's 1986 book, Manhattan 45, reprinted now in paperback, is a serenade to New York at the moment it became a world city. Morris's book opens with the arrival of the troop ship, the Queen Mary, into New York Harbor on June 20th, 1945. Wedding imagination to research, Morris describes what the returning soldiers saw. All around the waterfront, on every wharf and every vantage point, crowds were waving. The towers of the city glittered in the afternoon sun. Untouched by the war, they stood there metal-clad, steel-ribbed, glass-shrouded, colossal and romantic, everything that America seemed to represent in a world of loss and ruin. Manhattan 45 is exhilarating, but it also leaves you with the conviction that, time-wise, you've missed the boat. For many out-of-towners, visiting New York City in any decade would qualify as high-risk adventure travel. For John Krakauer, who survived the ill-starred 1996 expedition to Mount Everest, where five of his fellow climbers died, the capacity to be terrified by anything anymore must be severely diminished. Krakauer's book, Into Thin Air, is so suspenseful that while reading it, I imagined myself to be as oxygen-deprived as Krakauer was when he reached the summit. As Krakauer notes, climbing Everest was primarily about enduring pain. Just in acclimatizing to the high altitudes, Krakauer lost 20 pounds of muscle mass. That was before he scaled rickety ladders up moving glacial ice splinters and huddled in a tent near the summit through a night of minus 100-degree temperatures and hurricane-force winds. This isn't a swaggering yarn. Krakauer attributes his own survival largely to luck. He's also introspective about the morality of climbing, a potentially grief-inducing avocation that he somehow can't give up. Maybe it's too early yet to declare Into Thin Air this summer's must-read book, but I'll tell you that once I opened it, I broke all previous endurance records for non-stop sitting wrapped in my lazy boy.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Here's her list of suggested travel reading: Into Thin Air by John Krakauer, Manhattan 45 by Jan Morris, and the anthologies Traveler's Tales Guides to Hong Kong, Paris, and San Francisco. We'll close with one of Noel Coward's travel songs from his musical Sail Away, sung by Elaine Stritch. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a great holiday weekend.
Travel, they say, improves the mind, an irritating platitude, which frankly entre nous is very far from true. Personally, I've yet to find that longitude and latitude can educate those scores of monumental bores. Travel in groups and herds and troops of various breeds and sexes, till the whole world reels to shouts and squeals and the clicking of Rolleiflexes. Why do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home? What compulsion compels them, and who the hell tells them to drag their cans to Zanzibar instead of staying quietly in Omaha? The Taj Mahal and the Grand Canal and the sunny French Riviera would be less oppressed if the Middle West would settle for somewhere rather nearer. Please do not think that I criticize or cavil at a genuine urge to roam. But why, oh why, do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home and mind their business? When the right people stay back home with Cinerama, when the right people stay back home, I'm merely asking why the right people stay back on. Just when you think romance is right, it rather sharply dawns on you that each sweet serenade is for the tourist trade. Any attractive native type who resolutely fawns on you will give as his address American Express. There isn't a rock between Bangkok and the beaches of Hispaniola that does not recoil from suntan oil and the gurgle of Coca-Cola. What do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home? What explains this mass mania to leave Pennsylvania and clack around like flocks of geese, demanding dry martinis on the Isles of Greece? In the smallest street where the gourmets meet, they invariably fetch up, and it's hard to make them accept a steak that isn't served rare and smeared with ketchup. Millions of tourists are churning up the gravel while they gaze at St. Peter's Dome. But why, oh, why do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home and eat hot donuts when the right people stay back home with all that lettuce when the right people stay back home? I sometimes wonder why the right people stay back home. Ah, what peculiar obsessions inspire those processions of the families from Houston, Tex. With all those cameras around their necks, they will take a train or an aeroplane for an hour on the Costa Brava, and they'll see Pompeii on the only day when it's up to its ass in molten lava. It would take years to unravel, ravel, ravel every impulse that makes them want to roll. But why, oh, why do the wrong people travel when the right people stay back home with all that Kleenex when the right people stay back home with Eddie Fisher when the right people stay back home with all those Kennedys when the right people stay back home?